And it's 8:06 here on KPCW Park City. We'll begin our broadcast today with a birthday wish. KPCW's very own Leslie Thatcher, happy birthday today on this Thursday, October 17th. So, of course, she does have the day off. This is Connor Thomas filling in for her for the rest of the hour. And looking outside, it's dark and rainy, but gosh, air quality is actually looking very good for the first time in a while. Here with more on weather in the Wasatch Back, potential flurries. ABC's Nate Larson is on the phone. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Connor. Happy birthday, Leslie. We're finally seeing a pattern change, right? So nice to see some of the showers out there. Temperatures are starting to drop as well after being well above average or not even even flirting or setting new record highs over the last several weeks. So plan on showers continuing this morning. Should taper off into the early afternoon, but increasing again later this afternoon and evening. So we've got an initial front moving through northern Utah this morning. Following it, we'll see the core of a storm system that's moving into the Great Basin, reinforce it with colder air and another risk of showers, even some thunderstorms for the Wasatch Back. Temperatures should only hit around 50 degrees this afternoon in Park City and then drop to about 30 degrees overnight, which will give us a chance of some of those snowflakes, as you mentioned, in Park City and in Heber even, with snow levels down to about 5,000 feet into Friday morning. So with Park City at around 7,000 feet, we are expecting 1 to 3 inches of snow to accumulate with some of those colder temperatures arriving early Friday morning. About 40 for the high tomorrow. We'll see a chance of snow showers continuing, but moisture's decreasing throughout the afternoon into Saturday. Overnight lows just in the upper 20s on Saturday morning, a high of 50. So we're rebounding temperatures over the weekend, and a lot of the moisture is going to clear out. Should hug far southern Utah over the weekend, and there's really not a huge threat for anything in the Wasatch Back area now that the storm's pushing further south and east. As we get closer, we had thought maybe some showers would hang on over the weekend, but it's looking like it should shape up to be a pretty nice one, minus the cold starts. 31 on Sunday for the high, or for the overnight low, 52 for the high with lots of sunshine, and then sunshine will continue into early next week. Temperatures in the mid to upper 30s for overnight lows and low 60s for highs through Wednesday. Heber looking at a risk of storms, thunderstorms this afternoon and evening as well after some rain this morning, 57 for the high. Overnight lows into the 20s, 25 in fact, overnight with light snow showers expected, 46 for the high tomorrow, 21 for an overnight low as we get into the weekend for Saturday, 56 for the high. Temperatures stay very cold for overnight lows into next week, but our daytime highs warm to about 65 on Monday and should see 69 degrees by Wednesday next week with sunshine.
All right, ABC4's meteorologist Nate Larson, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, with the precipitation actively happening and planned over the next couple of days, it might not be the best weekend to head out on the trails, but here with details about what might be happening on those unpaved roads, we've got Executive Director of the Mountain Trails Foundation, Laura Anthony, on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, and happy Thursday, Park City. Looks like Basin Rec is reporting that we've just got mud out there and that the run amok cleanup day has been canceled. They might have to move that to a day when we don't have quite so much moisture in the air. Looks like Rick is just reminding us to stay on the paved pathways. All the trail signage from Mountain has been removed, so hopefully you know the trails well enough not to get lost out there. And then Mia from Wasatch Trails Foundation is reporting that aside from mud, they've moved the cutthroat parking lot off Highway 32 just east to stay out of the way of construction vehicles. And also they have a community movie night on Wednesday. I'm guessing that must be next Wednesday. You might want to check their website for details. They will have a movie that's done by the local high school writers. And again, for more information, go check Wasatch Trails Foundation. That's it for now, and we'll hope to see you out there when it dries up.
Yeah, wet ground turnaround for now, right?
Thank you very much. That's awesome, yes.
All right. Have a good morning.
All right. Yep, thank you. You too. Bye.
Coming up later in our broadcast today, we'll be speaking with Live Like Sam's Jessica Parker on the Wasatch Library Seekers and Sages program this year. Then U.S. Forest spokesperson Jeff Armstrong has an update on the ongoing Yellow Lake fire. Finally, Keith Lilly will be in studio to talk about the upcoming program Going Broke or Baroque with J.S. Bach and Friends. That's happening at the Shepherd of the Mountains Church October 19th. Well, Camas Valley residents will not vote on a new town until at least next year. West Hills boundaries have changed again, and not in time for the November ballot. The latest boundaries for Summit County's newest town contain fewer acres, and for sponsor and real estate attorney Derek Anderson, hopefully more people. The outline of West Hills, a proposed town between Camas and Hideout, has changed a handful of times now. The latest redraw was needed after Utah Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson's office says Anderson's previous iteration did not have the required 100 residents to proceed with incorporation. The new map, submitted October 11th, spans 3,600 acres. That's about 400 fewer than last time and 200 more than the original map. Different property owners have opted out along the way. Now all residents are locked in. That's because both windows to request exclusion from the Lieutenant Governor's office have closed. If the state finds that West Hills' new boundaries meet code, then LRB Public Finance Advisors will determine if it can raise enough taxes to balance a budget. That means incorporation won't be on the ballot until next November at the earliest. This year's ballots were mailed Tuesday. One more public hearing is required before the proposed town can progress to a vote. Only residents who live within the proposed town boundaries will get to vote on whether West Hills becomes Summit County's newest town. And High Valley Transit is asking residents to help shape the future of public transportation in Summit and Wasatch counties. Here's KPCW's Parker Malatesta with more.
The agency wants to hear from residents at an open house Monday evening. It's from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Richens Building in Kimball Junction. High Valley will also offer a virtual way to join in. High Valley's September board meeting agenda shows the agency is considering several new routes and changes this winter. They include additional service on the 107 bus route connecting Kimball Junction to the University of Utah and downtown Salt Lake City. Other considerations include increasing bus frequency in the Heber Valley and a potential new line called the Snowball Express, which would service Jeremy Ranch, Canyons Village, and Park City Mountain. The 104 route servicing the Kimball Junction area could also be expanded to include Pine Brook and Woodward Park City. High Valley Transit said everyone who offers feedback will be entered into a drawing to win a $25 Amazon gift card. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And here with me on the phone now, we have Live Like Sam's Jessica Parker here to talk about the return of the Sage and Seekers program, but this time to Heber instead of Park City. Good morning, Jessica.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for coming on. So Live Like Sam is partnering with the Sages and Seekers program this year. I gathered that it's moving to Heber in part because the former Park City librarian who organized it has moved to the Wasatch County Library. Can you explain the shift?
Yeah, I believe it was just a personal shift for her. But the program has shifted to the Wasatch County Library. Brittany and I worked really well together at the Park City Library to put on a really successful pilot program there. And it's just on hold there. We Live Like Sam hopes to continue to partner with the Park City Library to keep the program rolling once they get the staff needed for it. But for now, it's going to be at the Wasatch County Library, who has now adopted the program as well. And Live Like Sam and the Wasatch County Library will be facilitating the program. And yeah, I can dive in more when you're ready.
Oh, for sure. I think we should definitely start for listeners who've never heard of the Sages and Seekers program. Can you just do a quick, what is it?
Yeah, so the Sages and Seekers program is really wonderful and unique. It's actually been like a nationwide program now for, I believe, 13 to 15 years. It's an evidence-based program that we have adopted here in Summit and Wasatch County. And we've played around with the curriculum as well just to adapt it for our communities here. And so it is a program that connects seekers, who are teens between 14 and 19, and sages, who are adults 60 years and older. And we are connecting them for about an hour and a half each week for 8 weeks to just create authentic connections, share stories, share skills, connect over food, activities, games. And this program is so amazing because it not only gives teens that support and check-in every single week with a trusted adult, but it also gives it can bridge the gap between the generations, hopefully decreasing ageism, and just decreasing social isolation as well for our sages. So yeah, it's a really wonderful program. You know, we don't get to share stories that often anymore these days and have those authentic connections between these two generations. So we're hoping to do that and build that community.
Yeah, Live Like Sam is a nonprofit whose mission is broadly sort of youth wellness. What's the connection there with Sages and Seekers, and why do you want to get involved?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, we fully support community initiatives and community building. And then definitely our main focus is youth wellness and youth life skills. This program is very much so supporting that. So as I mentioned, just being able to provide youth a trusted adult to check in with every week that's outside of the house is really amazing for their mental health and allows them to hopefully, you know, we really hope that these relationships can continue after the 8 weeks if they've built enough trust and that this provides youth an outlet and someone else to connect with. So that's one thing. Another really wonderful thing is that youth are able to practice really great skills such as listening skills, conversation skills, communication skills, and building empathy through these storytelling and through bridging these generation gaps.
Yeah, could you dive into more of the nuts and bolts of the curriculum? It's an eight-week program. Is it just those weekly one-on-one check-ins? Are there group aspects? What will Sages and Seekers actually be doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So it's pretty cute in the beginning. Well, first of all, we will be like building up our Sages together and our Seekers together as well so that those communities are being built and those relationships are being built. So Sages will have time with their own generations, as well as Seekers will have time with their own generations to kind of help debrief the program and to help build the program as well. Like, we want them to come up with fun conversation questions that they would want to ask their Sages. And so we have fun little team building activities for the generation groups themselves. But what the program looks like is at the very beginning, we do like a speed dating kind of, where the Seekers get to go to each of the Sages and have a few minutes with them to get to know each Sage and learn their interests and see who they connect with and maybe who they might be motivated by or inspired by. And then we receive like their top three preferences for who they'd like to be paired with for the 8 weeks. And so we put them together with their pairs. And then for future meetings, that's who they'll be paired with. And our meetings are going to be really dynamic. So they're not just going to be sitting for an hour and a half with their Sage or Seeker pair. We, again, will have those generation groups. We're going to have different activities that they're going to be doing together. But for at least, 45 minutes to an hour, they will be with those specific pairs doing different activities at each meeting, whether it's teaching a skill or sharing stories over food, and we have games. We're going to, when the weather's nice in another season, we'll be doing field trips together. We have different communication exercises, and just we're trying to build trust between the pairs and also have them have really unique conversations through shared activity.
Yeah, and it culminates with a tribute presentation in December. Could you explain what that is?
Yeah. So at the very end, and this is another great way for youth to practice their public speaking and communication skills, the Seekers get to put together a tribute presentation. And what that looks like, it's a written letter, basically, but they're presenting it out loud. And this is on December 16th. From 5 o'clock to 6:30, and it's open to the public. It'll be at Wasatch County Library. So if anyone wants to come check it out, it will be really fun to see what the Seekers took from this program. So they'll share a tribute presentation that they wrote themselves, and they share it in front of all of us. They'll stand up on stage with their Sage and read aloud this tribute letter. And it's going to share the impact that the Sage had on them, the lessons that they learned, and what they took away from this program. And it's really, really a wonderful thing to be a part of.
Yeah. And something you said earlier was that this is an evidence-based program. What's some of the evidence out there? What sort of benefits does it point to?
That's a great question. So we are, let's see, the thing is we've definitely moved the needle just a little bit with our curriculum because, again, we've adjusted the curriculum for this community just to make it like a lot more fun, engaging, and a lot more activity-based. But what they are seeing in Sages and Seekers, with just connecting Sages with Seekers to have those authentic conversations, is that reduction in ageism and social isolation for Sages. It's helping Seekers and Sages find meaningful, just find meaning and purpose in their lives, and building community and practicing empathy as well. Sorry, I don't have the data like right in front of me, but it's real. It's just, yeah, I think just creating these connections together is building all of that. I can pull up the data.
No worries.
You can look up if anyone's really super interested about the evidence-based aspect of it. Sorry, I wasn't prepared, but sagesandseekers.org, again, is a national organization, and you can find all of the data on their website.
Sure. So how many people will you be taking, young and old, and how can people sign up?
Yeah, so you can sign up on the Wasatch County Library website, and you can also email programs@livelikesam.org to find out more information, and I can send you a sign-up link. We are accepting 15 Sages and 15 Seekers. We have space left. The program will begin October 28th, but we will be having Sage orientations next week, beginning Monday and Tuesday. So that's why we wanted to close the Sage registration tomorrow, or at least by the end of this week, so we could get them all signed up for their orientations that begin next Monday and Tuesday. The Seeker registration will be open until the end of next week. With a little extension, so I believe that's the 25th. And yeah, we'd love for you all to sign up and be a part of this amazing program, building community, and working together to bridge the gap.
All right.
Generations.
And do you think it'll become a permanent fixture there at the Wasatch County Library? And do you think it'll return to Park City?
Oh, 100%. This is in Brittany's heart, and she's. You know, we really love this program. I know the Wasatch County Library is so, so excited to bring community in this way and have this program. So it will certainly be running, hopefully, you know, 3 times a year. So
all right.
We'll see how it goes.
Sages, get the registration in this week. Seekers, you've got a little bit more time. But again, this culminates with a tribute presentation open to the public December 16th, 5 to 6:30 at the Wasatch Library. We've been speaking with Live Like Sam's Jessica Parker. Jessica, do you have anything else you want to mention this morning?
No, we're really excited about the program, and we really hope that listeners can help spread the word to any Sages or Seekers that might would love to be a part of this. Oh, one other thing I would love to add, which is really exciting for Seekers, is that they can receive volunteer hours for their time spent at this program. So it's a lot of volunteer hours for really impactful time spent. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jessica Parker from Live Like Sam, for coming on, and have a great Thursday.
Okay. Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
After the local news hour today, stay tuned for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. when Katie Mullally and Lynn Ware Peak speak with Eleanor Spicer Rice, PhD, who shakes your pet's family trees, peeks between their feathers, dives into their brains, and sometimes hitches a ride on their poops to uncover the meanings behind some of our animal friends' wildest behaviors. Then ophthalmic surgeon, physician, and neuroscience researcher Dr. Mithi Staroni discusses how to optimize your brain and transform the way you work. Her new book is called Hyper Efficient. That's all on Cool Science Radio after the local news hour today at 9. Well, the Park City Miners wrapped up their high school football regular season Wednesday night with a thrilling overtime victory at Springville. KPCW's Bill Skinner has the recap.
The Park City Miners outlasted the Springville Red Devils 17-14 in a hard-fought overtime battle on Wednesday night. Park City took advantage of windy conditions when two short punts by Springville set up the Miners deep inside Red Devil territory. The Miners capitalized on both opportunities to keep pace. With time running out and the game tied at 14, Springville looked poised to win the game, but missed a 27-yard field goal at the end of regulation. In overtime, Park City took a 17-14 lead on a 25-yard Tanner Pidwell field goal. Springville could not move the ball against a fired-up Miners defense during their overtime possession. They were forced to kick a long field goal for the tie. When the attempt sailed wide left, the Miners celebrated the victory. The Miners finished the regular season at 9-1. Playoff schedules will be announced over the weekend, and KPCW will have live coverage of all the Miners' playoff action. Also coming up this week, the North Summit Braves put their undefeated season on the line Thursday night at the Duchesne Eagles, while the South Summit Wildcats round out their regular season schedule at the Providence Hall Patriots on Friday night. For KPCW, I'm Bill Skinner.
And here with me in the studio, we've got Yellow Lake Fire Public Information Officer Jeff Armstrong. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Connor. Thanks for having me.
So, well, technically you're with Selkirk Fire in Idaho, so what brings you here to Utah?
Correct, yes. So I work north of Coeur d'Alene, and I work in the fire service up there. We have three fire districts that are working together, and what brings me down here is I'm in the national system for deployment, and I have a number of qualifications, and so when large incidents happen, they call us out based on our qualifications and ask us to fill these positions, and so we generally deploy for about 14 to 21 days.
Gotcha. So about how many different areas has the Yellow Lake Fire kind of drawn personnel from?
You know, just anecdotally, I'm kind of looking around base camp and talking to people, and I'm seeing folks from New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado. Certainly the incident management team is in from California. I haven't seen any California fire engines. There are some folks down from Idaho, including myself. There could be some that I'm missing, but it's well represented in the Western United States.
Great. So I checked latest acreage and containment late last night, and it was looking at almost 33,000 acres, almost 30% contained, but those are from yesterday. Do you have any updated numbers that you can share with listeners?
No, we're still sitting at 33,038, and we are at 30% contained now. And obviously, if you're looking out the window, conditions are getting favorable for us. So,
yeah, I was going to ask, so what do you anticipate to see today with it's rain down here? Is it snow up there yet?
I haven't confirmed with anybody that's on the fire line this morning how much snow is up there, but certainly that's what's predicted, rain in the lower elevations. And then right about Francis is the breakover line where we're supposed to get snow either later today or this evening.
And actually, we should probably situate the fire for people that don't know exactly where it is. It is in eastern Wasatch County there up Highway 35, which is still closed for firefighting efforts, public and firefighter safety. But people will have noticed the smoke, you know, this might be a false dichotomy, but are you winning or are you losing with the fire at this point? It sparked September 28th now.
Yeah, it sparked September 28th, and thank you for the geographical description there. Being from North Idaho, this is my first time to this area in Utah, and some of the names are a mouthful, so thank you for doing that. I'd say we're winning, and I think we've been winning for a while. I know folks are looking at the containment percentages, and they see it go up and down. They see the acreage continue to expand. We've gotten questions about, where are you just letting it burn in certain areas? And I think there's a relationship between acreage and containment, right? And we always focus our resources where there's values at risk, and that's a term we use for homes. But it's life, property, and an incident stabilization, and we're always going to make our tactical decisions based on that. So our first focus was the communities, making sure people were safe. The second focus was that property, those values at risk, those cabins that are up there. Last number I saw was between 50 to 60. I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but those were our focus. And so we were, I don't want to say steering the fire, but we were making sure that we got those portions of the fire under control so then we could go get the open flank to the north.
I mean, how does this fire compare to other ones you've worked? I'm guessing if you're in the national deployment system, you've seen plenty of wildland fires before. Is this one particularly hard to, steer, for lack of a better word, or what's its temperament?
So, I mean, the topography is always a challenge, right? I think what we're seeing here is a couple conditions. The amount of dead trees up there is pretty astounding. It's a beautiful area, but you will see those, what we call stringers of timber. You know, there's also dead that's down on the ground as well. And that makes it challenging for us to go in there because we can't put firefighters underneath it. So that's a unique dynamic. I've been on the operations side as well as the public information side, so certainly spent my time out on the fire line as well. And I will tell you, a little over 25 years in the fire service, and fires are burning differently now. You know, this is later into the season. I think it's been 2008 since Utah, specifically North Utah, had a late season like this. Mid-October, and a couple days ago, we were dealing with fire behavior that just really isn't seen at that time of the year.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, you might be getting some questions about containment and tactical decisions. What are some of those specific decisions you've made as to which side of the fire you're concentrating efforts? Are you concentrating like ground crews versus aerial mechanisms in certain areas? What are some of those specifics?
Well, I'm not up in the command level. Obviously, I'm working with the team and I'm disseminating information from them as well as observing what's going on. So the actual decisions I can't speak to, but I can tell you that it's that life, property, and incident stabilization that any incident command team is going to be focused on. And they're going to want to make sure that they get those values at risk protected, and then, you know, tie in portions of the line that are already contained. You know, you might have a small portion between two containment areas, and that's where the next area you want to focus your resources. So every day they wake up in the morning and they're looking at the maps, they're looking at the infrared flight from last night, and they're making those decisions on where best resources would be positioned on the fire to do the most good.
Yeah, and there have been mandatory evacuations ordered. Broadly speaking, these have been north of Mirror Lake Highway, starting at the Yellow Pine Campground up to about the High Line Trailhead, and then also in parts of Ashley National Forest, north of where the fire is, around sort of the different forks of the Duchesne River. Have there been any permanent homes in that area, though? Who's being evacuated? Like, just recreationists?
So there's, it's an interesting term. There's two things that are going on. There's forest closures and there's evacuations. And certainly homes have been affected, and we understand that people are wanting to recreate. This is a huge time, right, for hunting and recreating, and you're wrapping up your season. People want to get up there and close up their cabins. Last numbers I saw, it was, like I said, 50 to 60. I know up in Soapstone area, it's about between 20 and 30. I believe that I heard that there was one permanent resident affected by this. The big impact for the community is going to continue to be those forest closures, where we are asking hunters to not go into those areas. And that's just because if the fire does start to spread in that direction, you're talking about a remote area, no cell phone coverage, no improved roads, one way in, one way out sometimes, and then there's no accountability for them to be in there. Not that we need accountability for folks that are in the forest, but should something happen and we need to get them out. It was about 4 or 5 days before I arrived on the incident, I heard stories of them going and trying to evacuate folks with a helicopter and a bullhorn. So, you know, you can imagine we don't want to have that weighing on us. So it was a big decision to make those closures, and I know it weighed heavily on local officials.
Yeah, I mean, no cell service up there, so if you need to do it quickly, it's best not to have anybody in there when you do, you know, the fire does get close to there, I guess.
Correct, yeah.
I have heard of people or of rangers patrolling Mirror Lake Highway to make sure people aren't going back out there now. Have people been mostly respectful of the closures and of your space and sort of what you need to do?
You know, the community has been outstanding. I haven't heard of any issues out there. I'm also on occasion fielding phone calls on the public line, and so I do get inquiries all the time. Everybody's been understanding. Some folks have acted a little bit frustrated, and that's understandable, especially the folks that have been waiting all year to go hunting. But everybody has understood. I've taken the time to explain it to them, and I think that's the big thing, is you just take time to talk to people and explain them why you're making this decision, and usually we hang up the phone with a thank you. The community overall has been absolutely outstanding. They've been wanting to bring us food. I spend time going into the community during, you know, as part of my job, and I'll stop by the Chevron or the 7-Eleven there in Camas, and I'll talk to people. And I've been waiting for the questions. Well, what's going on? Why haven't you put it out yet? And the first question is, are you okay? Do you have food? Where are you sleeping? Are you taken care of? And I think that says a lot about this community. We had a volunteer group get together and do all our laundry for us.
I was going to ask, because what happened with the mobile laundry service, I guess, wasn't working at first or didn't get set up? What's going on with the laundry?
Well, everything going on in the country right now, you got to think all these responses. It's not just fires, right? It's the hurricanes. And so logistics can be a challenge right now. And so when the team was building this thing out, it was probably tough to get some laundry services in. And that's fine. We all pack for 7 or 14 days, and we don't expect to do laundry. But the community came up big. They set up a table outside base camp. Families, last I heard, there was 40 to 50 families wanting to do laundry. I took advantage of that and ended up getting a text message, hey, it's dropped back off at base camp. There was a note from one of their little kids in there. You know, and I won't lie, it got me in the feels. It was kind of neat to see that level of support, and I haven't really seen that in a lot of communities.
Well, that's great. For listeners at home, we're speaking with Public Information Officer Jeff Armstrong about the Yellow Lake fire. You just held up a drawing, so kids are posting some thank you notes around the base camp.
Yeah, we actually have a lot of them posted at base camp. There's a lot posted at the Ranger District office. When we're taking advantage of the volunteer laundry service, we're getting little notes in our laundry when it gets returned to us. Somebody got cookies. I'm jealous it wasn't me. Somebody else got a blanket. It's outpouring of community support has been great. We've had a couple community meetings, really good questions, but a really good opportunity to sit there and ask your direct questions to the incident commander, to the forest officials. The one that I was a part of, we estimate there was about 170 people there. So a really good turnout.
Great. Do you have any more information sessions planned at this point?
We do. We have a couple more community meetings, one on this side of the fire Saturday, and then one on the other side of the fire Sunday. I believe that's a tentative plan right now. The best thing for people to do would be go to social media for the two forests. I'm going to struggle with the name.
It's Uinta.
Uinta. I'm sorry. I had it down, and I was out there rehearsing it, and I came in here.
It's all shibboleths
forest
in Utah.
And Ashley,
yeah.
National Forest. It's a mouthful. Sorry about some of the pronunciation here in Utah. The two forests have website. Social media up. Facebook is a great one. We're managing that right out of the PIO office. And that's where all the information on the community meetings will be posted once it's finalized.
I think Tabiona is the only town I've ever done correctly on the first try. So it hits all of us when we come here.
I never had a problem with Wasatch. Wasatch was easy to me.
Interesting.
But the Uinta, I had to sit down and I had to spell it out. I had to practice it. And then I screwed it up.
Gotcha. Maybe take us back into the fire camp because the fire's in Wasatch County, but the road up there is in Summit County, so you're staging there in Francis. It's sort of a series of tents. Like, what is fire camp for people that never seen it? And it's kind of like a miniature city, right?
It is. It's a mini city. So obviously that's where we stage, and you know the incident command team comes in, and their job is not only command and control, but it's logistics. And obviously there's planning and finance and everything else that goes along with that, coordination with local officials. But logistics is a huge thing. And that's what keeps us clothed and fed and warm. And so they've set up basically a series of trailers and tents. And that's where you'll find your public information officer. I'm in a yurt, but I have a heater, so I'm good. And the incident commander's there, planning's there. And then a big thing is supply. If there's something we need, firefighters can come off the line, go to supply, either order it or get it out of the inventory. And then, of course, I have to mention food, and the food's been phenomenal. We've got a local caterer up there, and they're keeping us fed, and a warm meal when you come off the fire line. It's really good.
Yeah, and temperatures tomorrow morning will be about 30 degrees colder than they've been in the past weeks. Are y'all going to be all right? It's a lot of tents out there.
It is a lot of tents. And, you know, normally that's what people do, is they either decide to sleep in their vehicle. It's a small percentage of us to do that, or they sleep in tents. Because the weather is turning, the incident has ordered larger tents with large heaters. And so folks will be going in there on cots and staying warm at night.
And so there are different levels of incident response. I think we're at type 2 right now. If I'm, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but do you expect an escalation at any point, or do you expect, because of the weather, that you should be doing better here in a couple days?
I believe we should be doing better. I mean, we need to see what this weather's doing to see if it's going to be a season ending event. We don't know that yet. But depending on what the forecast shows, we could be. I would anticipate that the complex incident management team that's in there now will time out, and it will probably go back to local officials in the future.
All right. We've been speaking again with Jeff Armstrong. He's the public information officer acting right now for the Yellow Lake fire there in eastern Wasatch County. Jeff, do you have anything else that you want to mention today?
No, I just want to thank Utah for the hospitality, and it's been great to serve the community. It's been an honor to come down here.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, how do school districts attract and retain employees, and how would they manage more students? Eastern Summit County School Board candidates gave their answers at a recent community forum. A North Summit candidate and two South Summit candidates discussed their district's most pressing issues at the forum, hosted Monday by KPCW, the Park Record, and Park City Community Foundation. In the South Summit School District, incumbent Wendy Radke faces former Oakley Mayor Wade Wolstenhume for seat one, representing Oakley. They were asked about attracting and retaining employees as the cost of living rises in the Camas Valley. Here's Radke.
We did do a huge salary increase last year, and that seemed to help draw those teachers in and have them feel pretty comfortable with being able to live in the area or at least still commute if they couldn't.
Radke says the board was considering building district employee housing too, but tabled that until January. That's when new board members will be sworn in. Wolstenhume says he doesn't think the board should be in the housing business.
We just might have to find better ways to find places for people. I mean, with townhouses, with other people building and things of that nature.
In North Summit, Clark Staley is running to keep seat three, representing Hoytsville. That's where the Cedar Crest Village development is proposed. Over 2,000 homes may be phased in over decades if the Summit County Council approves it. The Hoytsville representative says that's why the current board put a $114 million bond on this November's ballot for a new high school.
But they have a formula to figure out what they think the increase in students will be with each home. So that was put into the plan in building the high school.
All candidates running for school boards in the Park City, North Summit, and South Summit districts were invited Monday night. Maggie Judy, Staley's opponent, could not attend. Two other races are contested in North and South Summit. Wayland Bond and Walter Yates are running for North Summit seat two, representing Colville. Garrett Carpenter and Dan Eckert are vying to represent Camas in South Summit's seat two as well. KPCW and the Park Record are working together to prepare a voter guide. Residents can see where Judy, Bond, and Eckert stand on the issues when it's released later this month. And Heber City leaders say they'll draft a new short-term rental policy after hearing locals' concerns. As KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports, some of the residents and council members agreed some of the proposed changes went too far.
City leaders have been searching for a way to set limits on short-term rental properties in Heber. They now say some of the proposed ideas are too restrictive. Council members agreed with concerns from locals at a meeting Tuesday, saying some suggestions overstepped what's reasonable. Late-night hot tub bans and limits on how many people can be on a patio were just some of the proposed restrictions. Tuesday's discussion came after residents packed City Hall 2 weeks ago to comment on the strict short-term rental policy draft. The proposal capped the number of people and cars allowed at each rental and limited late-night activities. Guests would not be allowed to drink, smoke, or vape anywhere their neighbors could see. They could not play music or make excessive noise that could be heard outside the unit. They wouldn't be allowed to use outdoor hot tubs or pools at night. And groups of more than a few people on patios or in backyards would be prohibited. It would also give the city the power to charge property managers with infractions, misdemeanors, or fines if their guests failed to meet the city's standards. Rental property owners, including Brittany Case, pushed back, saying other businesses aren't held to an equivalent standard.
Please help us to understand how these proposals are legal, ethical, and building our community. You're threatening to not only implement fines to us and our guests, but adding criminal charges. This is discrimination.
She said she and other vacation homeowners would sue the city if it moved forward with the proposal. Members of the council said they sympathized with property owners' complaints. Councilmember Mike Johnston said he's interested in creating a fair but enforceable policy.
Rest assured, we want to work with you and make something that's reasonable. I hope you can agree what's not reasonable is 20 people in the backyard at 11 p.m. playing music.
Plus, Heber City already has a noise ordinance restricting disturbances from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. Anyone found disturbing the peace could face misdemeanor charges punishable by up to 90 days in jail and a $750 fine. Johnston said he isn't in favor of restrictions on drinking, smoking, and gathering on a home's porch or patio. Heber City Police Chief Parker Sever also reassured property owners it would take more than an initial minor infraction for them to face criminal charges.
It's the nuclear option.
And Councilmember Aaron Sheetwood thanked residents for their input. He said their feedback is key to creating a policy that makes sense for the community. The council agreed not to vote on the drafted proposal Tuesday night. Instead, members will rewrite it based on the feedback they received and policies in similar Utah communities and present the changes at a future meeting. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Here in the studio with me, we've got Keith Lilly. He's organizing a Baroque music concert titled Going Broke or Baroque with J.S. Bach and Friends. Thanks for coming on the program, Keith.
My pleasure. Thank you, Connor.
All right. So this is going to be happening at Shepherd of the Mountains Church there on 224 in 2 days, Saturday at 5:30. Can you give sort of an overview of the run of show?
The run of the show is we started off first with a guest artist from Temple Square playing our Hauptwerk pipe organ. And a Hauptwerk pipe organ is as close as you can get to a real pipe organ. And so we've arranged to have Chad Staten come up to play four numbers by Dietrich Buxtehude. And the reason that's happening is, despite the fact that we said J.S. Bach, the organist said, "And Friends." That's what the program said. I said, "Yes, it said And Friends." So he said, "I like Dietrich Buxtehude." So I said, "Okay, he's one of Bach's friends. In fact, Bach walked 200 miles in Germany to talk to Dietrich Buxtehude." So he is our first artist. Our next artist is going to be a violinist who grew up in the Salt Lake City area. And he was part of the process, and a collaboratory process, with the GMS, Gifted Music School students in Salt Lake City. And I found out that that school has over 500 students and 50 instructors teaching young men and women, as well as the rest of the populace, classical music. And he is going to be flown down by his parents from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, Ezekiel Sokoloff.
Just for this event?
Just for this event.
All right.
Very supportive parents, although I'm sure that he'd love to get a break from school.
Definitely. I'll confess to have never met or knowing about any Buxtehude before. What is Baroque music for people that don't know or just aren't familiar with all the different types of classical? What makes it special?
Well, Baroque, I can't classify it specifically as far as the genre, since I'm not specifically a musician, but I would take it back to Bach's day and age, when Bach was composing his music and playing his music in Germany and that surrounding area. But Baroque does actually go perhaps 100 or more years before J.S. Bach. And I've grown up listening to Bach, and then I've listened to Buxtehude, and some of it I love, and some of it puts me to sleep. The stuff that puts me to sleep, well, sorry.
It's good in its own way if you want to go to sleep.
Very, very much so. That might be something you'd listen to.
If you're not a musician, why'd you get interested in organizing this concert?
Because I love music, and I fell in love with listening to organ music when I was in Orange County. I had a close friend who loved organ music as well. And believe it or not, he would be working a graveyard shift, and I would be over at his residence, and his wife and his two little babies at 8, 9, 10 p.m. in the evening, recording some of his records onto tape. So I kind of grew up loving the music. And while I was in the San Luis Obispo area, I had the opportunity to kind of support or push three pipe organs into churches there, saying, "No, you don't want a Rogers or an Allen electronic organ. You want a pipe organ." Unfortunately, they get very expensive, so that was the reason for the Hauptwerk organ that we purchased for Shepherd of the Mountains in Park City, Utah.
All right. And I think I interrupted you during the run of show. It also features five students from Salt Lake as well, future masters.
That is correct. We will have two cellists playing a Baroque piece, and we'll have two young people. One, I think, is about 9 years old, playing piano and organ. I heard one of the young men as he was practicing, and it's just astounding the quality of music that these young students from the Gifted Music School can perform. So it's kind of part of a collaboration of providing them an opportunity to perform for an audience, and it gives a good mix to the Baroque program as well. So we'll have guitar, and then one of the brothers plays piano and organ and also violin. And if someone asks him, "Which instrument do you like, piano, organ, or violin?" he'll say, "I love them all. I don't have a favorite." So this goes straight across the board with these young students as well.
And again, there are students there at the Gifted Music School in Salt Lake City. The event's free, right?
But the event's free. Looking at if the audience enjoys what they're hearing and listening to, we'll be taking up a free will offering to provide some form of remuneration to a couple of the musicians. And the balance would be going to the Gifted Music School because they are a nonprofit entity.
Gotcha. So what else would you like listeners to know about the concert, Baroque music, any future concerts planned?
Future concert after this would be, and my wife will kill me when she hears this, I will be following up with a Christmas concert in the mountains, which we started approximately 5 years ago. And that includes a bell choir, the Swiss bell choir, handbell choir from Midway. And it will include a virtuoso organist as well. And hopefully we'll be able to find a trumpet player out there. And I've found that trumpet players are very difficult individuals to find or obtain because they're out playing everywhere. So it will be a mixed program, and hopefully we'll have a number of students back from the Gifted Music School as well.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Keith Lilly. He's organizing Going Baroque with J.S. Bach and Friends. That's an upcoming classical concert at the Shepherd of the Mountains Church this Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 p.m. How long do you think it'll run?
Normally, I would like take a look at about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes. It's a reasonable time. We've got a variety of gifted musicians and music compositions that have been selected by various composers. So this will probably run approximately an hour and 15 minutes. And as you said, it is this coming Saturday, the 19th at 5:30 p.m.
All right. Well, anything else you want to mention before we go?
No, I appreciate your time here. I thought we might talk about the weather and snow, but I just see a little bit of rain on the outside, Connor.
Oh, snow is on the forecast, though. So exciting for me personally. Maybe views differ.
Hung them up a year ago, so I'm envious.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Keith, for coming on.
Thank you very kindly, Connor. Appreciate your time.
Deer Valley Resort will operate its new base village in Wasatch County for the first time when the season begins this winter. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has this report.
Deer Valley East Village along U.S. Highway 40 will open this season with 500 parking spots and three lifts out of the base area. Deer Valley Vice President of Marketing Susie English said the resort initially didn't plan to open East Village until winter 2025.
We were really focused on 25-26. So the fact that we're going to be able to ski over there this winter has been huge for us and worldwide press coverage and I think visitation, which will be great.
English said this winter, Deer Valley will open 20 new runs at East Village, adding around 300 skiable acres of terrain. For the inaugural season, three lifts will service the new base village, including a new six-pack bubble lift called Keatley Express, which will connect skiers to the base of Sultan.
So Keatley Express will go right out of the new Deer Valley East Village base, right into the Deer Valley existing terrain, seamlessly connect. So that will be great. So two other lifts that are much smaller will open this year. Hudo Express is beginner. Aurora is more of a connector lift to kind of get people back up and out to the village.
The McHenry Run, which starts at Silver Lake and goes past the Wasatch and Sultan lifts, will allow skiers to traverse back to East Village. English shared the other big addition, 500 Deer Valley parking spots at East Village starting this winter.
As far as accessibility for our guests, especially that live, over in the Heber, Wasatch County area, even out where I live in Trailside, right? Like to hop right on 40 and go to Deer Valley East Village is going to be a cool experience. We'll also have a temporary skier services facility over there.
And the following winter, Deer Valley's base area will expand with six more lifts that will open up more than 2,000 additional acres of skiable terrain for the 2025-26 ski season. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And this is Connor Thomas signing off on the local news hour this morning.